Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, the return of diet culture, this time with a conservative Christian bent.
And the long-hidden story of one of the first anthropologists to study the Chimoebi Indians.
But first, fire crews on the north rim of the Grand Canyon are conducting backburns to try to keep the Dragon Bravo fire from spreading further this morning. Weeks after it first began, the wildfire is 26% contained. It has burned more than 16,000 acres and destroyed dozens of structures, including the historic Grand Canyon Lodge. But it began as a small blaze ignited by a lightning strike on the 4th of July. Then fire managers made a critical decision. They let it burn using a tactic known as control and contain. But a week later, the fire was out of control, barreling past containment lines and leaving destruction in its wake. Now, the decision not to put out the fire immediately is under intense scrutiny. Governor Katie Hobbs has called for an investigation, and the fire continues to burn. Longtime Arizona journalist Annette McGivney dives into that decision and its aftermath in a new piece for The Guardian, and she joins us now with more. Thank you for coming on, Annette.
Yes, thanks for having me.
So begin for us with this decision to let this fire burn initially. You spoke with a member of the fire crew who made this call, who asked not to be identified. What did he have to say about their strategy?
Right. Well, you know, the National Park Service, unlike other public land agencies, try and really retain the original environmental character of the national parks. And so part of the natural character of Grand Canyon is fire. It's really an important part of the ecology. And most of that fire, you know, historically happened during monsoon seasons with lightning strikes. So It's definitely been plenty of times in the past when they would let lightning continue to burn and control it. And in fact, in 2022, in this same geographic region, there was the Bravo fire, where it started in July with a lightning strike, and they let it burn, and it grew to something like 1,000 acres, but it was controlled. And so, you know, but of course, there's been plenty of other times when fires got out of control. And so they, you know, decided that at the time when on July 4th that there had been rains, there was high moisture levels in the forest floor. And they decided, you know, it looks like moisture levels are really good right now. We should let this fire continue to burn and we'll control it. And what happened was there was just a crazy shift in the winds, and also the humidity level dropped, like went off a cliff.
Wow.
So anyway, you know, I would personally attribute that, you know, in part to climate change, with how just all these type of unforeseen things happen with the weather that people don't anticipate.
Yeah, conditions changed quickly there and the fire kind of went out of control. You spoke with this crew member I mentioned, and he talked about how the crew was overtaken. They had to take cover in the fire station there on the North Rim.
Right. Yes. You know, and this is, I've talked to one crew member and several other individuals, and I just want to clarify maybe that other people within the firefighting, you know, department have different opinions, and I wasn't able to, you know, talk to them. But according to the people I talked to, on July 11th, when the fire got out of control and the wind shifted, it suddenly started heading east toward the residential area of the North Rim and the visitor cabins and the lodge. And so they, you know, changed their plan, and they ordered a very abrupt evacuation for park employees. And those employees just had to just drop everything and leave without being able to prepare. And meanwhile, the park fire crew started hosing down buildings. But I also want to add that the day before, they had extra help with controlling that Dragon Bravo fire, but the Forest Service firefighters got pulled off to go fight the White Sage fire. Right. So on July 11th, when things got out of control. They were, you know, significantly understaffed. And so the firefighters started, you know, trying to hose down buildings, and they realized like things were getting out of control. But by then, it was dark. No helicopter could fly in to evacuate them. The fire was too big to drive out. And so they did take shelter in the fire station, in the residential area of the park. And there were also other crew members that were stranded on a helipad.
Wow.
And they were surrounded by flames, you know, that were several stories tall.
Wow.
And they definitely felt they were going to, the ones in the fire station, according to my sources, thought they were going to die for sure.
My goodness. So about a minute left here, Annette. I want to talk about what the Grand Canyon representatives have had to say as well. Other folks that you spoke with said that it was a mistake to let this fire burn initially. Now the governor's calling for an investigation. What's the response been from the Grand Canyon staff?
Well, the Grand Canyon staff has been not been able to talk to the media at all. Like it's been very shut down. So only press releases coming from the Department of Interior have weighed in. But the staff feels like their practice of, you know, allowing natural fires to burn has been unfairly vilified. And that maybe, you know, conditions change. And in hindsight, this fire shouldn't have been allowed to burn. But they feel like, you know, they were like having trouble because not only did conditions change, but they were also lacking equipment and staff for a variety of reasons. So I guess the political finger pointing is not helpful to the crew, the fire crew, and also the Grand Canyon environmental staff at this point.
Yeah. All right. Lots to watch for as the rebuilding will commence soon. Arizona journalist Annette McGivney wrote this piece for The Guardian. Annette, thank you for coming on. Appreciate it.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me.
Some employees of the Indian Health Service say a federal government efficiency effort is having the opposite effect. There's a new process in place for getting contracts approved, and these providers say it's led to shortened hours at emergency rooms and urgent care centers and reduced ultrasound services at one IHS hospital, among other impacts.
Angus Chin has written about this. He's a reporter with Stat News. He spoke with our co-host, Mark Brody, who asked about the process. What has to happen now that didn't have to happen this time last year?
Yeah, so the process that you're referring to is called PADR, and that stands for Presidential Appointee Approval and Departmental Efficiency Review. This is basically a process that provides additional oversight that didn't exist before when it comes to the fulfillment of contracts or requisitions. And this is something that seems to be happening across the federal government. It's not just limited to the Indian Health Service or to Health and Human Services.
And what does it require? Like if a physician in an Indian Health Service facility wants to do something or order a test or buy something, it has to go through different channels now than it used to?
Yeah. So the first thing that's important to know is that IHS hospitals rely pretty heavily on contracts. These contracts allow them to access services that are not, you know, within the direct hospital itself, like things that are not done by full-time employees of the IHS, like federal employees. So that can include any kind of reference lab that you might want to send samples to get a test done. It can be travel contracts for travel nurses or travel doctors, pharmacists, technicians, those kinds of things. These travel workers, you know, actually make up a good portion of the clinical workers at IHS facilities. And it can be supplies. So if a department needs to buy donor blood or they need to buy, you know, certain bits of equipment, all of those things are done through contracts. When you create those things, normally that can just go through the hospital and they have an approval process to buy stuff. But now it has to go up sort of the chain of command up to the acting director of IHS who needs to approve it. And then that needs to go to HHS, sort of the secretary's office or the Deputy Secretary's Office at HHS, where it undergoes this departmental efficiency review and gets final approval there. So there's these added layers of approval that sort of slow things down, and really slow things down to the point where people in IHS told me they don't know when they'll get certain contracts approved. And these are critical contracts. You know, these are contracts for clinical staff that the hospital needs to operate. It could be contracts for certain kinds of equipment maintenance, so like, you know, imaging equipment. And if you lose those things, then you actually lose that clinical service in the hospital.
Well, and I would imagine, as with so many things in the medical field, time is of the essence. Like you mentioned, you know, if you need to get a new MRI machine or contract with somebody to use their MRI machine, if it takes extra time, that's X number of patients who maybe won't get the results in a timely manner and lead to worse health outcomes.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly the concern here, is that if you end up losing a certain kind of service, and this actually happened at Gallup Indian Medical Center, which serves residents of the Navajo Nation, they were unable to get quickly a contract approved for a ultrasound technician. And because they weren't able to get that ultrasound technician's contract renewed when, you know, they needed to, they lost overnight ultrasound service in the emergency department. And this kind of had the effect of people who come into the emergency room, you know, after hours or overnight, and they need an ultrasound in order to get certain conditions diagnosed so that doctors know how to proceed. And so imagine now that, you know, someone comes in, they have an emergency, right? And this emergency, you know, you would normally diagnose it with an ultrasound, and you can't really see it that well in other kinds of imaging like CT. And this person experiencing that emergency now needs to wait to get that emergency resolved, either by waiting until the morning when sort of the ultrasound technician is able to come in, or by being transferred to another hospital, which again can take time.
How prevalent are these problems where hospitals have had to either delay services or miss out on services? You mentioned the facility in Gallup. Is this happening throughout the IHS system?
The delays seem to be happening throughout the IHS system, at least wherever I was able to talk to people who work at IHS facilities. And my impression was that the Gallup Hospital was one of the worst situations that I ran into when I was doing reporting on this story. But other hospitals, you know, clinicians at other hospitals I spoke with said that they were running into similar issues, but they hadn't quite lost the same level of services that Gallup had. But it was certainly was causing them a lot of stress and a lot of administrative burden and employee overload to deal with this new process, this PAS-DIR process.
What are federal officials saying about this, like anyone from HHS or the Indian Health Service itself?
Yeah, so I spoke with a spokesperson from HHS, and I also spoke with Mark Cruz, who's a new senior advisor in Secretary Kennedy's office. You know, the HHS told me that they created this new process in response to one of President Trump's executive orders on governmental efficiency. And they said that this process had not interrupted IHS's ability to fulfill any responsibilities, and that the goal of this departmental efficiency review was to make sure that federal spending is, quote, aligned with the best interests of the American people. You know, the statement that this review has not interrupted IHS's ability to fulfill clinical responsibilities is just definitely false, because I got memos from IHS hospitals that showed that they were losing medical services because of this new process, because of the slowdown that was happening because of this process.
Did the federal officials have any response when you pointed that out to them?
No, they simply pointed me to another spokesperson at HHS when I brought this up.
So is this sort of the way it's going to be going forward? Like, do folks who work in the IHS facilities seem to think this is just sort of the new normal now?
I don't know. I think that people are hoping that this process will either become more streamlined in the future or that it'll just go away. You know, one person I talked to said that they felt that IHS should get an exemption from the DER, the Departmental Efficiency Review process in government. And their argument was that because IHS provides clinical care, like medical care, in a way that really not many other departments of the government do. You know, the exception would be the Veterans Affairs and also the NIH hospital, which, you know, does a lot of clinical trials and through that will provide care to patients. No other part of the federal government really provides healthcare in this way. And when you change the way the government works, it can interrupt the flow of care in these facilities. And that has an impact on people's health. And so I think people in IHS really hope that there will be an exemption for IHS when it comes to this process. And that's what they're asking for. Whether or not they'll get it, I think is up in the air.
All right. That is Angus Chen, a reporter with Stat News. Angus, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Great. Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, going from good Democrat to a more radical leftist, we'll discuss a collection of essays chronicling one author's political journey in our newest book club series.
But first, in the 1970s, anthropologist Lowell Bean made a startling discovery. He was digging through the archives of another anthropologist named John Peabody Harrington, a legend in the field, who made a career out of capturing linguistic records in indigenous communities. Buried deep in Harrington's files, Lowell Bean came across a 20-page report on the traditions and customs of the Chemehuevi tribe in Arizona. The report was credited to John and Cara Beth Harrington, which confused Lowell Bean. He had never heard of Cara Beth Harrington, who had apparently helped gather ethnographic materials on a tribe that few other anthropologists had researched. John Peabody Harrington had been dead for a few years, so Bean sent a team in search of Cara Beth. They found her in an apartment in Los Angeles with a Chemehuevi woman who turned out to be Cara Beth's daughter. Cara Beth was 71 and had been living in obscurity for decades, but she had quite a story to tell. Writer Denise Hamilton recently told that story in a piece for the journal Alta. I spoke with Hamilton about this enigmatic woman who changed the face of anthropology.
She was from a very progressive kind of liberal family, well-traveled in Mexico and throughout the U.S. Her father was a newspaper publisher. She had already had a child out of wedlock at 17. And her parents were like, well, just we'll take care of the child. You go get an education.
Wow.
And so it was not a very usual family for 100 years ago. So when she was taking either a linguistics class or a history class, and she met this professor, John Peabody Harrington, and they started up, seeing each other. I think she was 19 and he was probably in his 30s. She was very smart. She was very good with languages. She was very sharp, and she really took to this kind of research. So they decided to get married, and they had embarked on something like 10 years of ethnographic research. And he taught her how to do field work. And they basically went from one Indian village to the next. And some of these were already very impoverished, dying, very few native speakers. And they went around and collected linguistic information about these Indian groups and tribes.
So this period where she's traveling around with Harrington is sort of remarkable, right? Because they're living under extremely austere conditions. She is training to do field work in his very particular style. And then at some point, she becomes pregnant with his child. And that's where things take a bit of a turn, right?
Yes. Even though he had a stipend from the Smithsonian or the federal government or somewhere to do this research, they didn't have any money. And so here she's 19 and she takes off and they're living in these huts in these Indian villages. And he would take off for months at a time and leave her behind. And she would run out of food. She'd be sick. If not for the tribal members of these villages where she was staying, she would have died. And so she was pregnant. And when he found out that she was pregnant, he wanted her to have the baby in the village because he wanted to observe all the, you know, childbirth rituals and religious rituals. And she put her foot down on this. I mean, she was only 19. She was a teenager.
So just to be clear, he wanted her to make the birth of their child part of his ongoing research project.
Absolutely. absolutely correct. Yes. Yeah. So she went home and had the baby. So now she had two children, but you know, she couldn't bring the baby back with her to do the research. So now she leaves a second child at home with the grandparents and goes back to the villages and continues her ethnographic work.
I would have to imagine, Denise, that as much intellectual stimulation as she was getting out of this, she was also married to this person who is, you know, taking off for weeks at a time and leaving her alone. It doesn't sound like much of a relationship.
No, she was a very social person. She wanted love. She wanted affection. She wanted intimacy. And she was getting none of that. And she was slowly realizing that. And then he also did not want a second pregnancy because that would have gotten in the way of her being able to continue researching for him.
Right.
So he decided, we're not going to have regular sex anymore. We're going to have, quote, unnatural sex, which she wrote about in her book, Encounters with an Angry God. And she said that this was not pleasant for her. You know, she wasn't happy with this at all. So this is the setting by which, I think we're in the early 1920s by now.
Yes, I think it's 1923 when, in the midst of all this, Harrington sends her here to Arizona on an ethnographic assignment, and that really changes the course of her life.
Yes, the anthropology community at that time, when they found somebody to interview who would help give them information about the tribe and the customs and the linguistics, they called them, quote, informants. So Harrington had heard about this informant named George Laird. And so he sent his wife to Arizona to the Chemehuevi community there to do her interviews. So he was a blacksmith and he was in his mid-40s, but he was very willing to talk to her in a way that many of the Native Americans of the time were very suspicious and, you know, rightfully so, of these, you know, white academics coming in and just kind of grilling them. So she developed this kind of warm, friendly relationship with George Laird. And at some point it turned romantic. But she...
This is a time, right, when there were miscegenation laws on the books and racism was quite rampant.
That's absolutely correct. And especially an educated young white woman from a, quote, good family. This upended the entire social order. But Carol Beth was her own woman. And I think that George Laird offered her the affection and the respect that she wasn't getting at home at all. So she told her husband, I am leaving you for your informant. They ended up getting married. They had four children. They lived in incredible poverty. You know, he did odd jobs and he helped people in the neighborhood. And at night, after they put their children to bed, they would sit in the kitchen and she would be at her rickety little manual typewriter and they would talk and she would ask him questions and she would write down the answers. And because she had been trained by one of the most eminent anthropologists in the country, and she was a smart young lady, she knew exactly what kind of questions to ask and what kind of follow-up questions, and she wrote it all down. Fast forward to 1941. George is driving some kind of a tractor, and the tractor collapses on top of him.
Oh, God.
And he dies.
This must have left Carol Beth in a very difficult circumstance.
Yes, she had no husband. She had no help. She's got four kids. And she thought, we've been doing this research at night. I've got all this data. She reconnected with her ex-husband and said, I'm going to send you this 20 pages and maybe you can help me get it published. So what happens is Harrington receives it and probably reads it and thinks that it's pretty good. So he slaps his own name on his ex-wife's manuscript.
Right.
So that now the authors are Harrington and Carol Beth Harrington, when she's really the one who's written it. And he shoves it deep into his notes. There it languishes for decades, until Lowell Bean unearths it.
So she is published. And then, as you alluded to earlier, she also ends up publishing this memoir, Encounter with an Angry God.
Yes, that was her whole life story about, you know, her life with Harrington and then leaving him for George Laird and their poverty, but their research, and they had so much love and respect for each other. And it's really the chronicle of a very avant-garde woman who made her own way at a time when women found it very hard to do so. She was just irrepressible.
Well, Denise Hamilton is a crime novelist, an award-winning journalist, and wrote this wonderful piece for Alta called Unearthing a Buried Treasure. The treasure in question, the anthropologist Cara Beth Laird. Denise, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
From tacos to lo mein, some of the best food in America comes from immigrants to this country. Well, our next guest says some of his favorite meals come from the mixing of immigrant cultures. Think brisket tacos or using a tortilla to scoop up pork adobo. Rudy Guevara is a professor in ASU School of Social Transformation, and he's the co-editor of the new book Culinary Mestizaje, a collection of essays and recipes that explore how racial mixing is creating new food cultures across the country. Guevara calls himself Mexipino. He's of Mexican and Filipino descent. And he told me he grew up surrounded by different cultures in San Diego.
I was exposed to Samoan food because my father was also raised in the South. I grew up on soul food as well. And, you know, there was a lot of different culinary sort of things that we were exposed to with our friends and communities. And, you know, we would eat at each other's houses and cultural events and whatnot. And so, you know, I was also exposed to Chamorro food and others. So it's like, for me, I think growing up in these communities that were very multiracial and the foods we had, what we shared with each other and our friend groups in many ways really impacted me and sort of influence what I would eventually do with my own research and writing.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a clear line there. So tell us like a favorite dish from your childhood, something that might encompass this kind of multiculturalism for us.
I mean, you know, some of my favorite dishes are either Mexican or Filipino, but then, you know, we sort of, so let's say, for example, so for Filipino, you know, I really loved adobo, whether it was pork or chicken adobo. That was sort of one of the staples on heavy rotation, you know, in our household. But then there was also, you know, Mexican food. You know, my mom made a really amazing chile verde. You know, we had mole. We had like different other types of food. You know, tacos are really big in San Diego. And so, you know, all the different kinds of tacos that we had. But I think one of the things that I remember growing up is that because I was in a Mexican and Filipino household, we always had a pot of rice and we also had tortillas.
Yeah.
So let's say, for example, we had some pork adobo and we didn't have any rice. We ran out of rice. You know, I would just grab a tortilla, and scoop up the meat and, you know, boom, you got a taco. It's
super
done.
Good.
You know?
Yeah.
And then we just added the condiments on top and that was it. So it was normal. It wasn't really like, it's just what we did because, you know, we just ate the food and you know, created these things with what we had.
Yeah.
And it was just sort of normalized because it wasn't something we thought about like, oh, this is a great invention. It was just part of our cultures and the blending and how it mixes. And it shows up in, you know, in one of the most amazing foods ever. And that's a taco, you know?
Absolutely. One of the most amazing foods ever. So you're making me hungry, but tell us how you make us more hungry, right? So you and your co-editor here kind of traveled around the country, cooking with some of the contributors to the book, gathering stories for it about various other kind of multicultural cuisines and the histories and cultures those come from. Tell us about the experience of creating this. It sounds like fun.
No, it was an amazing experience. And, you know, a lot of the people we approached were friends and colleagues and just people we knew throughout our lives that, you know, came from places that had multicultural or the intermixing of foods together in different regions throughout the United States and even in Hawaii. But also, like, you know, a number of the folks were also mixed race. So it's sort of like this thing of like telling a personal story that happens to sort of reflect what it means to grow up in these particular places and how food informed that identity.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there have got to be some kind of surprising combinations, food influences that you have highlighted here. I mean, you went all over. This is from, like you said, California, Texas, but there's Maine in here, Atlanta, Hawaii. What were some of your favorite kind of surprises, culinary surprises that came up?
I think one of the ones was, you know, for me, was East Los Musubi, which, you know, our friend Natalie Santizo did, which looking at the sort of this Hawaii style food, right, the spam musubi, but sort of mixed with, you know, within a Mexican cultural intersection. And so I think that was something that was really interesting because you're getting, you know, these particular places coming together in Los Angeles and having this experience. And then, you know, you also go to Hawaii with our friend Rod Labrador, and, you know, he's talking about the history of the plate lunch and sort of how these certain things come together and why. And so you get a sense, a historical context of how these foods come about. And, you know, not just historical, but also in our contemporary moment, why these things come together.
Right.
And it makes sense. Once you read the stories and you understand, it makes sense. You know, everybody had their own story of how food and memory came together. And I think that I was really meaningful in terms of how you could see what you sort of what we have in common and what brings us together with an intimate experience such as food and sharing food and combining food and sort of what those historical and contemporary moments look like in the creation of a dish.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I wonder this because, right, like you're studying this, you're gathering stories, you're telling your own story here as well. But what does that mean to you? Like, what has learning about this and writing about your own culture and your own foods taught you about yourself?
I mean, for me, it's taught me that I'm not alone in this experience. And it's a beautiful thing because, you know, when you see all these different stories, you know, and, you know, I'm also mindful that these stories do come with, you know, a lot of luggage. You know, you're looking at white supremacy and racism and colonialism, enslavement and genocide and all these things that occurred historically, which brings layers of moments when people come together, whether in conflict or in cooperation. And over time, these things have shaped certain regions of the United States to create those moments where these now the individuals that have been combining their food have been able to then, you know, create something that's very reflective of their experience in their city or their region, whatever it may be. Those things all play a role in it. So it's not like just a kumbaya moment of coming together, but it has baggage that evolves over time. And this is what is sort of the creation or the moment that people experience in a dish that has all this behind it.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that I hope people can come away with is that these things occur and they're continuing to evolve. You know, who knows what food will look like in 10 years or in 20 years. And I think, you know, it's very reflective of our society as a multiracial society and what can come about when we come together and in these common experiences, rather than focusing on hate, hatred and fear and division and trying to really, in many ways, crush the voices of people of color and indigenous people who contribute and have shaped American food.
All right, we will leave it there for now. That is Rudy Guevara Jr., professor at ASU School of Social Transformation and co-editor of the new book, Culinary Mestizaje. Thank you so much for coming on, Rudy. Thank you for explaining this and congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. There were a lot of notable quotes from the recent Young Women's Leadership Summit in Dallas, Texas, but this one stood out to our next guest.
You are in this room and you are witnessing a cultural revolution. Less Prozac, more protein.
It was uttered by wellness influencer Alex Clark, who is one of many conservative voices online who is wooing young women to the MAGAverse. But to Jessica Gross, it signaled something else. The return of diet culture, this time with a conservative Christian bent. Gross is an opinion writer for the New York Times who recently wrote about the movement. I spoke with her more about it and how influencers like Clark are characterizing their liberal counterparts.
What really stuck out of me was five shades of autism is her description of liberal people, liberal women specifically. And basically, conservative women have their lives together, and having your life together includes eating protein and being in shape and being married and having babies and just ticking all of these boxes. This is the quote about liberals. TikTok activist with five shades of autism, panic attacks, and a ring light.
Okay. So you're zeroing in here on this idea that diet culture, which has been around forever, is now once again kind of tied to Christianity, though it certainly hasn't always been that way. Like you talk about Kate Moss and like when being skinny was definitely coded as leftist, right? What are some of the moments where we've really seen the opposite?
So diet culture is just universal. Right. I feel like there are very few subcultures in the United States where being fit or being slim is not valorized. So, based on what's trending in the culture, it shape shifts. And so, right now, because we have a conservative running the country and that's the trends that we're talking about right now, the shape is a conservative shape. And so there's been many previous moments where that has happened before. And so a recent one was about 12 years ago when the megachurch pastor Rick Warren co-wrote a diet book called The Daniel Plan. It was a super bestseller, millions of copies sold, and it included lines like, God isn't going to evaluate on the basis of the bodies he gave to other people, but he will judge what you did with what you have been given. Satan does not want you living a healthy life because that honors God. And why should God heal you of an obesity-related illness if you have no intention of changing the choices that led to it? So that is sort of a typical framework, which is being overweight is gluttonous and it is your personal responsibility and your sort of moral responsibility to be slender or be a healthy weight. I think where it becomes really problematic is online, because it's not just about eating healthy or exercising. It becomes extreme, like everything online, which is a valorization of extreme thinness that is not healthy for most people.
So you're talking about this connection between morality and thinness and self-control, right? So I have to ask about Ozempic and the way that that has changed the conversation around obesity in general. How much has that changed this conversation when it comes to sort of the Christian moral side of it?
Well, I think some people, and again, I don't want to paint with too broad a brush, but there is a faction that believes that Ozempic is taking the easy way out and it is not having control over yourself. Kelsey McGinnis, who is a writer for Christianity Today, and she's working on a book about Christian diet culture, told me that she heard from a former Christian wellness influencer who told her that there's this backlash brewing to Ozempic because it doesn't require you to bear any self-control, which is the fruit of the spirit. But what we know now about the science behind obesity is that overeating isn't about willpower. These drugs have taught us that there's a biological function that is blunting people's ability to know when they're full. So it isn't just, oh, you don't have willpower. Our understanding has really evolved.
That's interesting. So the Make America Healthy Again movement, I'm sure, is part of this conversation today as well, and RFK Jr., et cetera. How is misinformation that surrounds that playing into this as well?
So RFK, as far as I know, is also not a big fan of Ozempic. But I see a sort of similar desire for purity in that movement. A lot of what they want to do, I agree with in terms of making our food supply healthy and getting chemicals out of our air and water. But a lot of the ways that they go about solving those problems are not the way that I would go about solving those problems.
It's interesting. You really say, though, that this isn't about thinness or fatness really at all. Like it's about controlling women's bodies from your point of view and kind of keeping us occupied with that.
So I think while there are other pressures on men in terms of their body shape, I think that there's a lot of pressure on them to have big muscles and, you know, have abs and look a certain way. So I don't want to suggest that men have no pressure to look a certain way. Mm-hmm. But for women, the ideal is always ever smaller. It's to take up no space. And when you are not fueling your body, you don't really have that much energy. And when you're not taking up much physical space in the world, you don't tend to have a lot of power. So I think it is related. It's all sort of tied together.
Yeah. So this is about more than just taking up physical space. This is about sort of women's roles in society and the ideal from the Christian point of view right now.
Right. But I mean, again, the ideal is perpetual. Hmm. Whoever is pushing it and whatever justification they give for pushing it changes over time and changes based on whatever trend. But that ideal, I mean, especially sort of in the predominant white culture, because I think other cultures have more leeway and have a greater diversity of body shape that they admire. But yeah, I think it's right now we're seeing the way that it is interpreted through the lens of a country that has been moving in a more conservative direction in the past couple of years.
All right. We'll leave it there for now. Jessica Gross, New York Times opinion writer, joining us to talk about one of her latest columns here. Jessica, thanks so much for coming on. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. To close today, we are bringing you the first installment of a new series we're calling Book Club, which is exactly what it sounds like. Every month, we're going to bring you a conversation about a book that we're intrigued by and which we humbly suggest you might be intrigued by as well. And this month, that book is I Want to Burn This Place Down, a collection of personal essays by the Brooklyn writer Maris Kreisman. Joining me for this first installment of the show's book club is Deborah Sussman, the Senior Director of Marketing and Communications at ASU's Herberger Institute and a personal essayist in her own right, as well as a book reviewer. Deborah, good morning.
Good morning, Sam. Lovely to be here.
It's lovely to have you. So to start, I thought we could share an excerpt from the book. The book, as I said, is a collection of essays, but there is a sort of central idea that runs through all of them, which is Maris's experience with living with chronic diabetes and how that makes her think about structural issues in the United States.
Absolutely. And so this particular passage comes in an essay where she talks about meeting the man she would marry, and realizing that from that she gets health insurance. That health insurance is tied to finding love is just as cruel and absurd as tying it to your profession. A hard-won lesson that took me longer to learn than I'd like to admit. There's so many things we can't control, no matter how hard we might try. No one's health should suffer for that. Imagine if all the morsels of advice that were flung at me as a single woman applied to not only the mysteries of human connection, but access to basic human necessities. It really changes the tenor of the discourse, doesn't it? Dating like it's your job, just so you can get that prescription filled. Learning to love yourself so you can see that specialist. Wearing a date night top that is the perfect blend of sexy and sophisticated so you can get that MRI. These feel like terrible pitches for dystopian reality shows. Back off, TLC. Rather than sound strategies for taking care of one's health and well-being. Although I suppose living with a chronic illness in America has always been something of a dystopian reality show.
Yeah, that button line, I think, really drives home a lot of what Maris is going after with this collection of essays. And I'm curious to know what you felt about this, Deborah. But for me, one of the things that was remarkable about reading this book was that I don't think I had ever really read a personal account in such great detail of what it's like to deal with having a chronic condition and practical ways that that forms the entirety of your life. There's one passage in particular where Maris talks about going out with her husband, Josh, for an anniversary dinner. So hard to get reservations at this restaurant. This is a night that they've been craving for a long time.
And it's their anniversary.
It's their anniversary. And with every bite of food she takes, she has to then quickly look at her phone to check her glucose monitor to make sure that it's not throwing her out of whack. So it's like she's having the experience, but she can't be fully in the experience.
And not only can she not be in it, and this is what she's so good at, she helps you understand how little control she has over it. There's this sort of idea that if you have a chronic illness, there's some personal responsibility for how well you're doing.
Right.
And as she walks you through that particular meal, you understand just how little anything that she is doing, because she's trying to do everything right, is affecting her numbers, and her numbers are rising.
Yeah. There's another passage that I wanted to share quickly that I think gets at this, where she says, I'm always wondering if what I feel is normal, if there is such a thing, if I'm so exhausted at the end of a hot day that I must cancel my plans to sit in front of my air conditioner and drink Gatorade Zero, is that what regular non-diabetic people feel like too? Has the heat become more physically taxing for everyone? Or is it because heat interferes so thoroughly with my diabetes that what I'm experiencing is particular to me? Or is it all of the above, plus the planet is literally on fire, and what does normal feel like anyway?
She does that so beautifully, right? Takes her personal situation and puts it in context.
Yeah.
And this passage in particular really struck me. Full disclosure, I read the book, and then I listened to it with my daughter, who's 27, and has a sort of chronic auto-inflammatory disorder. And that was the passage where my daughter, like, started snapping. It was just the whole idea of what is normal,
right?
Right, and how do I know what's normal? And always questioning whether something weird is going on with your body. I think my daughter found this book incredibly validating.
Yeah. Well, this brings me to something, Deborah, that I felt was less successful in the book, and I'd be curious to get your take on this, because this quality of gradual realization that the world does not work the way you have been taught as a child it perhaps should is so compelling in the sections that we've been talking about. But there's another section where Maris writes about realizing that some of the propaganda about cops as good guys that she has ingested from shows like Miami Vice and Brooklyn Nine-Nine, she's coming to question those feelings.
The copaganda,
the
if copaganda, you will.
The copaganda, yes. The chapter, I think, is called Copaganda and Me. And there's a moment where she reveals that she has two twin brothers, both of whom are police officers.
Yeah.
And I had this great hope as she revealed that, that this was going to lead into a conversation between her and her brothers about their experiences as cops, so she could try to bridge this gap a little bit. But that conversation never happens. And I felt such a letdown at that moment, because it felt like a betrayal of this sense of curiosity that had been cultivated up to that point. What did you think of that moment?
That's interesting. I felt like it was almost an unbridgeable gap. That one of the things she talks about in the essay is how scrupulously she has to avoid discussing this stuff with her brothers because they have kind of gone down a rabbit hole.
Right.
And the media that they consume, kind of the way they see the world, is so fundamentally different from her way of seeing everything, her way of being in the world. And I think we talk a lot about the divide in American society right now, and to me it felt like that was emblematic of the fact that some families can only continue to get along if they don't talk about this stuff.
Right. Right. True, true. Well, and this gets to the title of the book, I Want to Burn This Place Down. And Maris writes throughout the book about how, in many ways, this is the story of her radicalization, her arriving at the conclusion that not only does she disagree with many conservative viewpoints, almost all, but mainline Democratic views no longer seem to suit her. And she feels like there's this need for structural revolution to the system. Did you feel, well, how did you feel about her attempt to express that?
So
I'm tipping my hand.
Tip away. So part of what I loved about this book is it is so much Maris's voice. It is, you know, she seems like a really smart, interesting person who is trying to piece it all together. And her way of processing it all may not be mine, but there were many things that echoed for me. What I love is reading those essays has changed the way I see the world a little bit. It hasn't necessarily changed the way I think about the world, but I see echoes of what she talks about in, for example, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which is a show that my daughter and I watch. It's a thing that we had been talking about anyway, but to read it through her, eyes is sort of astonishing from the vantage point of somebody who has two brothers who became police officers.
Yeah. Well, as Maris puts it, pardon me, in the book, there is comfort in other people's stories to learn that I am not the only one aching to move past my own petty concerns. So we'll leave you with that intriguing line. The book is I Want to Burn This Place Down, and I've been talking to Deborah Sussman. Deborah, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sam.
And as I mentioned in the intro, we'd like to do further installments of the show's book club. So on August 27th, we will be discussing Gary Steingart's Vera or Faith. We hope you'll read along with us. And if you have thoughts on Maris's book or Gary's book, send us an email, theshow@kjzz.org.
All right, that is it for this edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more. And you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter now. It's called Radio Heads. And you can sign up at theshow.kjzz.org. For Sam Dingman and Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us. That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.